experts told us what they thought it was. BBC said, you know, we don't know what this could, you could have been set up. It's always one of our fears. And we have to authenticate it. Like when I had the contracts showing that the black folk were deliberately purged in Florida, one way we confirm, we just go to the people whose documents it is, and we say, this, explain it. And, you know, when I was in Florida, and I showed the Catherine Harris's voting director the purge list, and I wanted to ask him about it, and he just, you know, ripped the microphone off and ran to his office, slammed the door, and called the state police to remove me. BBC took that as a confirmation that it was his. But I thought, well, maybe he just had another appointment. There's big smokies coming. Come on. So we took our cameras to RNC National Headquarters in Washington, got the door slammed in our face. We went down to Florida to the state party chairman there, and they put out their PR flack, Mindy Tucker Fletcher. And I said, missing something? There, I mean, I had hundreds of these, right? Hundreds of pages. So, oh, it says caging. Caging lists, spreadsheets. Oh, caging list. Republican Party donors. It's a donor. Okay. And I went through several pages of men in homeless shelters. I said, a lot of donors in the men's shelters, you know, thankful for the opportunity to sleep out in the open air. Okay. We had another idea. This was a challenge list, a secret list to challenge voters on election day, maybe before. So now, remember, if they're challenged, then they go to the provisional ballot. Now, these are not felon voters. These are in all these states. They were not felon voters. They were voters with suspect addresses. So what's so suspect about these guys? We looked at, like this list here, Naval Air Station, Jacksonville, Naval Air Station, Jacksonville, all the way down, Naval Air Station, Jacksonville, on and on, pages and pages and pages of African American airmen and sailors and soldiers. We called one, Randy Prousa. His wife answered, he's not here. Where is he? Well, he's been shipped overseas. The Republican Party had mailed letters first class to all these black soldiers and men in homeless shelters who would be registered there. And they wrote on each of the letters, do not forward. And when the letters came back, they had evidence of a suspect address. That person ain't there. We know that every guy on this list ain't there. They're in Baghdad. Now, I just want to explain, in case you're wondering, it is not illegal for a soldier to vote from under a Humvee in Fallujah for President of the United States. Even a black soldier is allowed to vote. But the mass challenge, the huge mass challenge of voters on Election Day, was a virtually unreported story in the United States. And the deliberate aspect, the caging list, was completely unreported in the United States, except on we put this on the top of the BBC Nightly News, by the way, top of the Nightly News worldwide, the world's biggest network. Not one word from an American network, except for ABC Network, I'll give them credit, they had a little story on their website saying that there was a false report being disseminated by BBC television about Republicans attempting to remove voters. And their source, by the way, was Mindy Tucker Fletcher. But, you know, one of the questions, why didn't they tell, besides the fact that maybe they shouldn't do that to soldiers, why didn't they say that they were challenging voters? Remember, 2% of the voters, by the way, were not African Americans. They were the majority Jewish precincts in the retirement communities in Florida, which is also a Democratic demographic. So they kind of went after the elderly of Zion as well. You know. But, see, there's a problem with that. It's called the law. 1965 Voting Rights Act made it a crime, a jail time, hard time crime, to target groups of voters for challenges or interference in their right to vote in any manner, even if you have some excuse, you suspect their address. It's against the law if race or religion is part of your program. So that's why they kept the secret. Of course, they say, well, now we busted them. Were they going to get busted? Well, we went to the civil rights voting cop, John Ashcroft at the time, and he directed us to his press spokesman, Mindy Tucker Fletcher. So you just, you know, I showed you the plan. Page 73, privatization, especially in the oil and supporting industries. They didn't privatize or sell off the oil fields because democracy reigned. No, I was wondering what happened. What force is more powerful than gopher nose twists and his corporate roster? And then after 2 years, I gotta tell you, 2 years of grueling research by the team, we found, got something 323 pages long, the plan that was put in effect that they denied in writing over and over again didn't exist. And this was a page from it. I smell Baker. James Baker. James, in fact, the particular one, James Baker III. Now, the third, in case you don't know who he is an attorney who is better known as the consigliere to the Bush family and the Republican Party, the guy who boasted, in fact, in front of a BBC reporter, I'm the guy that fixed the election for George Bush in Florida. He was a lawyer for Bush v. Gore. He was kidding, of course. Senior counsel to Carlyle Group, lawyer for ExxonMobil Corporation, and he's a lawyer in the September 11th lawsuit. As you know, the families of the victims of September 11th have sued the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for funding Al-Qaeda. Because Osama and Zarqawi don't put this stuff on their credit cards, the money came from the Arabian Peninsula. So the kingdom was sued as an accomplice. And James Baker, of course, represents the Saudis against the families of the victims. And of course, his main office is the center of our government, Houston. But he also has a satellite office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He actually has, James Baker represents the Saudi government, ExxonMobil, Carlyle Group, has an office, not even Dick Cheney has an office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. It's true. And I called the White House about this. They said, well, you know, in fact, sometimes he works at the president's desk in the Oval Office while the president plays on the rug. Okay, I made that last one up. He does have the office at the White House, right in the White House. He's not just a person, he's an institute, the James Baker III Institute, where his operations, the big political operations, are run. So I talked to a few oil company guys, who later, when I published some of this in Harper's, that you'll see in our meta, you know, they told me that this plan was crafted by James Baker's people in Houston, even though their name is not on it. It says, you know, U.S. State Department. So this document, I actually probably shouldn't read it to you, because I can't read it to you, because it says contents confidential, should not be reproduced, distributed, or publicly released. I'll show it to you anyway. What is it that Baker III, his institute, Exxon, Saudis, what is it that they wanted? The key to the whole thing was to create a system in Iraq, an oil company, a state oil company, and a state oil ministry. The purpose was to enhance a government, they meant Iraq governments, enhance the Iraq government's relationship with OPEC. What's that about? First of all, OPEC is the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. It's otherwise known as the oil cartel. It's otherwise known in legal circles as a conspiracy against trade. It's a felony organization. It's a gang, a mob. If they did it in the United States, they'd be doing hard time on a chain gang. But there is an exception to U.S. law, which, by the way, has a provision in which U.S. law extends our antitrust reach, as does other nations' laws, because cartels to fix prices, and that's what they do. That's what OPEC is, an organization for fixing prices by limiting the supply of oil. But there's an exception to the law, which is that if you wear a bathrobe and a crown, you're off the hook. But it is a violation of the law. If any American participates in any foreign cartel whatsoever, it's a violation of U.S. law, or takes actions which benefit that cartel against the interests of the United States. So you notice this document is confidential. Now, am I saying that enhanced relationship with OPEC suggests that James Baker, who represents Exxon and Mobil Corporation, his institute developing a plan for the United States military to occupy a nation to enhance the relationship with OPEC is an illegal conspiracy against the public from his office at the White House? I don't want to suggest that. But the question is, how do you enhance OPEC? You know, enhance your relationship with your wife by giving her flowers. You enhance your relationship with the Lord with prayer. But how do you enhance a relationship with an oil cartel? The answer is you squeeze the supply of oil. You limit it to what OPEC quota has been set for that nation by Saudi Arabia. That's how it works. That's how you enhance your relationship. Now, why? Let me give you oil economics lesson number one. You heard I studied with Milton Friedman. Lots of international economics. And one thing I learned, real simple, the less oil, the higher the price. Rule number one. Rule number two, the less oil, the higher the price. So when oil companies go exploring, including when they use their exploration company, the 82nd Airborne, it is not, as many people have written, among the progressives, to find or bring us back oil so you can fill up your Hummer cheap. Okay? It is to find the oil and turn off the spigot. The less oil, the higher the price. And that's why when people say George has screwed up, oh, he's made a mess of it, just like he screwed up with Brigham on, got reelected. He screwed up. The oil blew up. The pipelines blew up. Remember, we're going to get all this oil. Even Wolfowitz promised it in testimony before the United States Congress. Remember, Iraq will be free. Now, he didn't mean Iraq will be free like a democracy. He meant Iraq won't cost us a dime. What? Iraq will be free. No, you know, free ride. We can bomb them. They'll pay for the bombs with their oil. Remember? Was he lying? I spoke to the guys that gave him the information, and they said, well, we told him something else. And by the way, as a racketeering investigator, you tell someone something and they testify and say something else under oath, that's perjury. That's perjury. That's hard time. Did Wolfowitz perjure himself? He was told one thing and he testified to something else. And my publishers are worried that. They say, you know, you write that and you're implying the guy committed perjury. No, he didn't. Paul Wolfowitz did not commit perjury. See, because his buddy in the State Department, Elliot Abrams, who was convicted, as was Ollie North, of perjury because they lied under oath. When Wolfowitz testified, check the record, he never raised his hand. He never raised his hand and said, I swear to tell the truth, so help me God. None of the Bush boys, when they talk about Iraq or oil, ever raise their hand. no perjury. No truth, no perjury. Now, less spoil. So the deal is, Saudi Arabia sets a quota of 3 million barrels a day. That's it. That's the program. Not to get the oil. It's worse than no blood for oil. It's no oil for blood. So, wait. But this is an old story. To understand the history of this, how this happened, how this came about, it's not something new that they just came up out of Houston. It's an enforcing an old policy that goes back to the day Iraq was invented by Winston Churchill in 1920, Winston took the fields, oil fields of Kirkuk, the oil fields of Basra, and what they thought were oil fields in Baghdad, and tied them together for Anglo-Persian Corporation, now known as British Petroleum, and said, by the time he got to the bottom of his brandy bottle, you're Iraq. But they needed a king. So Britain called in Faisal. And they said, you're king of Iraq. He said, what's Iraq? He says, it has a capital in Baghdad. He says, where's Baghdad? Don't worry about it. You'll love it. So they brought in Faisal. He immediately gave the entire rights to all the oil of Iraq to a guy named Khalous Gulbenkian. And Khalous then, of course, turns around, as he was supposed to, and sells the rights, 95% of it. That's why he, to this day, he's still called Mr. 5%. 95% to Anglo-Persian, now British Petroleum, Standard Oil, now Exxon, James Company, Total, Royal Dutch Shell, all the big oil companies. And in the floor of a hotel room in Brussels, 1925, they spread out a big old map of the Arabian Peninsula and took a big red pen and circled Iraq and Syria. And every oil company executive signed on that red line, promising never to drill that oil. Less oil, higher the price. Okay? Oil was being discovered all over the world, and the price of oil in 25 was dropping. They promised never to drill. Now, the British Foreign Office is very nervous. You got a bunch of restless Sunni Shiites, Kurds. So, Anglo-Persian, British Petroleum. There's actually a memo. It's stunning to read this. A memo from an executive to the Foreign Office saying, don't worry. We're drilling in Iraq. Shallow wells in places where you're certain never to find oil. Continued on until 1964, when Iraq said, enough. The contracts say you got to drill, you're faking it. There's hardly any oil coming out. We got as much oil as Saudi Arabia, almost. So they expropriated, they seized the oil fields from British Petroleum and Exxon. The Prime Minister of Britain called up the President, John F. Kennedy. See, we talk about wars. Let's talk about the war that didn't happen. And he reminded Kennedy that, of course, under Eisenhower, when the Iranians nationalized the oil fields, that Mossadegh, the president, was removed with prejudice. Okay? And part of that plan, go back to those CIA memos at the National Archives. Part of the plan to bring in the Shah, they said, what we need to do is activate the fundamentalist Islamic religious organizations to declare that an elected democracy in Iran is un-Islamic. We need to activate the mullahs. And they did so, and that created a popular uprising, removed the democratic government of Iran. And thank God that's never come back to haunt us. But when the British Prime Minister reminded Kennedy, look what we did in Iran, we got to take care of these Iraqis. Same thing. And Kennedy said, the oil companies and the British government, British Petroleum and Exxon, have been stealing so much from the Iraqis for so many years that this is not an expropriation. This is justice. There was no war in Iraq. 1963. And then Kennedy's policy was suddenly changed. The less oil, the higher the price. Did George screw up in Iraq? When Bill Clinton left office, oil was 20 bucks a barrel cheaper than peanut butter. Today, it's $73 a barrel. Mission accomplished. Mission accomplished. And that's why they have to kill Hugo Chavez. I'll show you. This, from inside the Department of Energy. When I showed this on BBC TV, the Department of Energy called and said, how'd you get that document? What it says is, talks about Orinoco extra heavy oil resources. How much? Orinoco is in Venezuela, which means it's underneath Hugo Chavez. And it shows that Venezuela has a lot of oil. Five times as much oil as Saudi Arabia. Five times as much oil as Saudi Arabia. Now, I showed this to President Chavez last month when I was down in Caracas. Of course, he knew this. if he ever wondered whether the question was whether the United States knew this, and if he ever had any doubts about that, he got the answer from the president's spiritual advisor, Reverend Robertson, Pat Robertson, said, Hugo Chavez thinks we're trying to assassinate him, and I think we should just go ahead and do it. So I talked to Chavez about that. And he said, look, I would like to make you, and he's talking on BBC television to a billion people and heads of state he knew would watch what we're saying. I will offer President Bush, Mr. Danger, as he calls him. I'll offer Mr. Danger and the rest of the West. Oil one-third off what you're paying now. Let's stabilize the price. The Saudis jumped the price up, and then to knock out alternatives from my heavy oil, which is expensive, to drill, to wind power, to solar power, they suddenly every 6 or 8 years dumped the price of oil to $6, $10, $12 a barrel. No alternatives. The windmills are silent. And then when there's no alternative, boom, it's back up. He said, let's cut the up down. It's killing my economy. Boom, bust. It's eating America alive and destroying the third world. Let's bring down the price of oil to a reasoned price, not too low, not too high. He said, I shook Bill Clinton's hand onto this. And now George Bush wants to chop his hand off. Why? And the answer goes back to enhancing OPEC. And what do we mean by OPEC? Every oil guy I spoke to said the same thing. OPEC is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is OPEC. What's the big deal? Our president, why does our president ride around in that golf cart with King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia? Well, one, he's in the golf cart because George is afraid of horses, right? But it's true. That I didn't make. He's afraid of horses. There's one single picture that we've been able to locate at BBC of George Bush on a horse, and the horse is dead, stuffed. I'm not kidding. they had a picture of him, looked like he's on a horse. I'm not kidding. You pull back, and it's like he's on a... Of course, he may be on a rocking horse somewhere. We don't have that. But why is he going around the golf cart with Abdullah? To get Abdullah's oil? Abdullah can't drink it. His harem can't drink it. He's going to sell it to us or somebody. He's going to put it out on the market. He doesn't want Abdullah's oil, petroleum. He's addicted to Abdullah's petrodollars. Petrodollars. Remember the film Network, right? And there's a kind of a truth-telling TV journalist who says, enough of this oil cartel. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And then this big mogul brings him into a corporate conference room and says, Mr. Beal, let me explain. The Arabs have taken billions of dollars from us, and now we must get it back. It flows out. It comes back in. It is the ebb and flow of international finance. And you're concerned with nations and people. There are no nations, there are no people, there's only Exxon and DuPont. It goes out, it comes in. It's gravity. Well, Chavez decided to defy gravity. Because, see, part of the deal was, besides cheap, stable oil, peace is one. The other, he said, I'll give you the oil, but I'm not giving you the petrodollars. Money for Venezuela stays here in Venezuela. We can't be an oil colony anymore. The last big oil boom ended with 1 million people living in cardboard shacks on the hills of Caracas. When the money came in this time, I've been there before, and this time when I returned, the same places that were cardboard shacks are now brick houses with computers in them and medical care. Okay? He said, that's what it's for, and it's for Latin America. And to make the point, he just withdrew $20 billion from the United States Federal Reserve. See, Abdullah, here's how it works. The flow, Mr. Beale. They charge $3.50 at the pump. ExxonMobil's takes a slice. The Saudis passes on to the Saudis, take a little slice. Jim Bob takes a slice and a slice. And then it comes back. $253 billion went out to the Emirates for their oil and the Arabian Peninsula. $311 billion, a third of $1 trillion, came back. Actually more, because some of Japan's money was taken and came back to the United States, a little bit to try to buy the ports. But most of it, see, they're just trying to get the money back. They don't even know where to put it. Except most of it goes back in the form of purchases of U.S. Treasury bills and securities to fund George Bush's spending spree, a $2 trillion deficit, a $2 trillion increase in the national debt, 100% of it paid for by these foreign borrowings. The oil is the key. The petrodollars are the key. We don't get taxed, they say, but you are taxed. That's a tax at the pump. So that it goes out and it comes back after these guys take their slice. ExxonMobil made $10 billion every 3 months this past year. No one's seen profits like that since the Pharaohs. Exxon's reserves have grown in value since the war began by $666 billion. Two-thirds of a trillion, $666 billion. You know, mission accomplished. $2 trillion spent supposedly stone sober. So, and Chavez takes out $20 billion from the United States Federal Reserve, cashes in his treasury bills, and lends the money to Argentina and Ecuador. So he's got a date with the bullets. So what are you going to do about it? You know, I just told you that they've caged the voters. 1.9 million voters were denied, ballots were cast in 2000. 1.9 million and not counted. They cranked it up with provisional ballots to 3.6 million in 2004. In 2008, they're going to work it to 5 million with the new voter ID requirements. What are they going to do about it? Martin Luther King III, I was meeting with him and a bunch of civil rights leaders in Alabama. And he said, Greg, I'm going to take your book and place it on my father's grave. And I know he'll be pleased. And it was pretty moving. But I thought, and I told him, you're just going to get the book dirty. There's got to be some better idea. And Jesse Jackson, he really did. King said that. And Jesse Jackson said, who is sponsoring, by the way, he is another sponsor of the Armed Madhouse tour through Operation Push. He said, "Greg, we march, we win. We march down Pennsylvania Avenue, and we throw the book through the window." At the Jim Baker's office, I suppose. No, he said, "We march, we win." He said, "When we crossed the bridge in Birmingham in 64, we didn't have the vote, and we won the vote. In 72, we didn't have the peace in Vietnam, and we marched, and we won the peace." Okay. And you might say, marching doesn't make a difference. Well, I can tell you, if you don't march, it will definitely not make a difference. And he said, "And vote." And I was immediately thinking, you know, come on, they're taking the vote. What's the point? But, you know, I was thinking of being in Mexico. The point is back in Taos Precinct 13. They're not going to count their votes in the Pueblo. And they know it. They still vote. And you know what else they do? Because I got to tell you, as you well know, if you know the Native American culture, their kids go into the military. They're the ones. They are the suspect voters. And every morning at Taos Precinct 13th in the Pueblo, the natives, the veterans, raise the American flag. And they salute it. And they raise the flag and they salute it. Even though they know that no one's going to count their vote. You can take away their land, and you can take away their resources. And you can take away their votes, and you can even take away their kids to Iraq. But they'll be damned if you're going to take away their country and their flag. And that's your job. Their vote doesn't count. 5 million votes will not be counted in the 2008 election. You are going to commit tonight to bring 6 million new voters to the polls. That's what you're going to do. Tonight, you commit to it. And if they keep 140,000 troops in Baghdad, you will put 140,000 people in every street in America. We can do that. That's not much to ask. And there's just one thought I'm going to leave you with, that something our president said that I agree with. Yeah. Before he went into Iraq, he said, "I want to speak to the Iraqi people." And he said, "Do not fight for a dying regime. It is not worth your life." It isn't. Thank you very, very much.
That was BBC investigative journalist Greg Palast, author of Armed Madhouse, speaking last month in Seattle. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. Can the U.S. legitimately even claim the title of democracy, or is it an emerging or emerged police state? Michael Smith and Michael Ratner are two New York City lawyer activists in the field of constitutional and human rights. They were part of a panel addressing the emergence of a police state in America at this year's Left Forum, an annual conference of scholars and activists in New York City. We'll conclude with excerpts from that panel, first with Michael Smith, then Michael Ratner, who heads the Center for Constitutional Rights and who has been heard on this program before. Both are co-hosts of Law and Disorder, a radio program heard on WBAI Pacifica in New York.
The title of our panel, 10 Minutes to Midnight, The Emerging Police State, was suggested to us by a magazine that is put out by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. The magazine first started coming out in the 50s, and it addressed itself to the fearful problem of an inevitable nuclear war. And as the United States grew more and more reckless in its nuclear policy, the clock on the front of the organization's magazine, which was set at 11:45, kept moving closer to midnight. And I think that's certainly true today, not only of nuclear holocaust. You see the United States just selling nuclear technology to India. That clock is advancing. It's advancing ecologically, obviously, and it is certainly advancing with respect to our constitutional rights. 10 minutes to midnight is actually the wrong title. Congress passed 88-10. They passed the law extending the Patriot Act. 10 minutes to midnight is the wrong title. At this point, it should be 9 minutes to midnight. And who knows what it's going to be next week. A police state doesn't emerge overnight. When Michael and I were working last year on the book, The Emerging Police State, it's a collection of writings by the great constitutional lawyer William Kunstler, and I edited the book with Kunstler's two daughters, and Michael wrote the introduction. And when we were talking about the title of it, we thought, perhaps The Emerging Police State, that's a little shrill. Maybe we should calm down. Too much, The Emerging Police State. But you know, in retrospect, we were absolutely right about this title, because that's indeed what's going on. The final solution wasn't announced as the final solution. The final solution came later. It should have been more accurately the initial solution. Things creep up and creep up. There's a law that you won't find in the New York State codified laws or in the federal laws, but a law that I think applies to what I'm talking about. It was Hegel's first law of dialectics, that quantity eventually turns into quality, that something that is only possible eventually becomes inevitable, that if you put salt on French fries, they taste pretty good, but if you put too much salt on the French fries, you can never eat them again. And that's the direction that we're going in. Things are becoming irreversible. The example that I'd like to give is the example of an obscure Austrian house painter named Schicke Gruber. You know who I'm talking about. Huh? They name people like this. Schwarzenegger is a fellow countryman of Schicke Gruber's. He was an Austrian who became the dictator of Germany. But he didn't become the dictator of Germany overnight. The Weimar Republic, the constitution that the Germans had that was set up after the First World War, was the most democratic constitution that had ever existed in the history of the world. Within a dozen years, it was shattered. How did that happen? Hitler didn't take absolute power initially. In fact, he was appointed legally Chancellor of Germany by a feeble, ailing, elderly German aristocrat. Hindenburg appointed him Chancellor. At that time, his party did not have a majority in the Reichstag. The German parliament had 41%. The next strongest party were the communists. They had 35%. The Nazis staged the burning of the parliamentary building, the Reichstag, the symbol of German unity. How did it work? Hermann Göring, one of Hitler's top functionaries, took this half-mad young Dutchman from his house through a tunnel to the Reichstag. They carried with them two cans of kerosene, and the Dutchman set the Reichstag on fire and burned it down. They then staged a political trial. And with the Dutchman, they tried the leadership of the Communist Party. The leadership of the Communist Party had nothing to do with the burning of the Reichstag fire. You know, just as, say, Lynn Stewart, in her representation of the Sheikh, had nothing to do with terrorism or the war in Iraq or the airplane flying into the World Trade Center. Nothing to do with it. They made an amalgam between the Communist Party and the crazed Dutchman, and they tried him. Now, in those days, Hitler had not yet cleanse the judiciary. He hadn't yet, to use a current reference, put a lot of Alitos on the Supreme Court. And the judiciary was independent. And the defendants had subpoena power. The head of the Communist Party who was on trial was Grigory Dimitrov, who was a Bulgarian who was the head of the German Communist Party. And he was able to defend himself. He didn't use an attorney. He used the subpoena power. He called Hermann Göring to the stand, and he destroyed him on cross-examination. In fact, Göring walked off the stand before cross-examination was finished. And as he walked off, he whispered to Dimitrov, "I'll get you in the streets." Sounds like something Cheney would say. And indeed, they did. They didn't get him in the streets, but they executed him later. The Dutchman was found guilty. The communist leaders were not found guilty. In one of Hitler's initial reforms, he brought back guillotining in public, and they cut his head off in the public square, a public assassination, really. The Communist Party, however, was associated in the minds of the public, and principally the middle-class public, because the working class was organized in the Communist Party and the Socialist Party, but that broad grouping in the middle class, who were scared to death because of the insecurity in Germany. And despite the reality of it, the Communist Party was associated in the mind of the public with the burning of the Reichstag. Just like today, despite the reality of it, Iraq is associated in the mind of the public, certainly initially, with the burning of the World Trade Centers, weapons of mass destruction. They threatened the United States. And it was this kind of fear that Hitler played upon. So when Hitler had 41% of the vote in the Reichstag and wanted to consolidate his power, what did he do? He issued two decrees in February and March of 1933. After the Reichstag fire, he was able to do it, and the two decrees gave him the power to legislate. The power to legislate. So you no longer had checks and balances in Germany, just like more and more we're not having checks and balances in the United States. And when you have a situation where the executive can not only execute the laws, but make the laws and call the armed forces of a country into play to enforce those laws, that is the definition of a police state. And that's what happened in Germany. And without being alarmist, that is the process that's going on in the United States today.
New York human rights lawyer Michael Smith. Here's Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I remember writing an article in October 2001, and it was called "Moving Toward a Police State, or Have We Arrived?" And I thought then, maybe that's too dramatic, because at that point, what we were facing, we had the Patriot Act in front of us, we had internal detentions in the United States, we had the lifting of the FBI guidelines that we had fought really in the 70s and 80s for, that came out of the fight over what had happened to the Black Panthers, the communists, going all the way back to the 50s and the 60s. And I saw what was happening in the country with fundamental rights. But at the same time, I thought it might be risky to talk about moving toward a police state. Was it really moving toward a police state? A police state to me is one in which there's no check on the executive. The executive wakes up one day, he decides to arrest you or you or you, he decides to bomb something, he decides to do whatever. It's really a dictatorship. And I said moving toward a police state, and that really became for me a crucial beginning of what I saw happening in the country. And since that time, of course, we're 4 years later, 4 years of these panels, and every single month things get obviously much worse in terms of what the administration is attempting to do. In a few minutes today, just broadly bookend what I consider to be a couple of the crucial issues that make me convinced that this country is now, on many levels, become a tyranny. And we begin with not just what I said about in October 2001, shortly after 9/11, but I begin with the day I woke up and I saw on November 13th, 2001, that the president had issued what he called Military Order Number 1. Military Order Number 1 is the one in which the president said, "I, as the President of the United States, can arrest, detain, kidnap, whatever you're, capture, whatever word you want to use, any non-citizen anywhere in the world. I can do that, and I can hold them forever. I never have to try them. I can simply hold them forever. And there's a part two of that order that says, well, if I ever decide to try them, we can try them with a special military commission, kangaroo court, whatever colloquial term you want to use. So you have this order. This is already in 2001. We've talked about it at prior panels. It's well known. It's based on the president's claim of commander-in-chief power. It's blamed on a view that he can do whatever he wants. I consider that sort of one bookend to what I call this moving toward a police state, or really tyranny in America right now. The other bookends, and I don't know what one will be there tomorrow, but the ones that have come up in the last few months, and then there's a lot in between from Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib, but the ones that have come up in between are the ones that took place on December 30th of last year, and of course the one that just took place recently having to do with spying, electronic surveillance. December 30th of last year, the president signed the McCain Amendment. I consider that the other bookend to tyranny. The McCain Amendment, as you may recall, is the one that bans cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, a form of torture. It was passed because the Congress said, finally, we're going to pass this. This has always been prohibited under U.S. law, but Congress said we're going to do it again. They didn't do it in a great way, which I'll talk about, but they at least did it. It comes up to the president, and the president says, well, I never really liked this law. I didn't want Congress to pass this law, and I'm going to, in a, what's called a signing statement, I'm going to say what I think about this law. And I'm just going to paraphrase. It's one paragraph, but if any of you have any questions about whether or not there has been a coup d'etat in America, read that paragraph. You can't say you didn't know. What it says first that as the president, I can do what I think is necessary to protect national security, paraphrasing, even if it means torturing people. I call that the Pinochet defense. So that signing order took place. It says, first, that I can do whatever I want in the name of national security, even torture people. Secondly, it says, I can ignore Congress completely. I don't care what they do. And third, it says, I can ignore the courts. So that's what I consider the other bookend. And in addition, of course, we have the bookend that took place at the end of, right now it's continuing, the national security wiretapping. And that, of course, is where the president believes that he has the inherent authority to electronically surveil any of us. The Center for Constitutional Rights, where I work, brought a litigation against that. Our plaintiffs in that case actually are center attorneys, because what our center attorneys do all the time is communicate with people all over the world or their families who this administration believes are alleged terrorists. Now, what you've seen, of course, is an utter laydown in Congress on this law. Any legal arguments about this law are utterly and completely ludicrous. There's no legal justification at all for what the president is doing. And in fact, in my first case that I ever brought at the center, the famous lawyer named Arthur Kanoy, it was a challenge to warrantless wiretapping under John Mitchell, and we held that unconstitutional when Arthur argued in the Supreme Court. And now, of course, we're seeing that again. So those are the basic bookends of what I consider to be essentially a tyranny in America. In terms of the facts that have happened in the last 4 years, of course, as probably a lot of you are aware, the center has been for 4 years now representing the Guantanamo detainees. And now we're seeing national calls to actually close down, worldwide calls, to close down Guantanamo. Now, what Guantanamo represents is, first, arbitrary detention. The idea under that military order, under the president's commander-in-chief authority, that you can do whatever you want to human beings anywhere in the world, pick them up, and put them in Guantanamo. We won in the Supreme Court the right to have those people go into a court. And then what happened, if you have any thoughts, 2 years of litigation later, if you have any thoughts about what our Congress did, Democrats and Republicans, I want you to think about Guantanamo. Because there we had what's called the Detainee Treatment Act. And 2 years later, after we get 500 attorneys to start representing Guantanamo detainees, people from all over the world, really, to represent people, all over the country, Republicans, Democrats, and others, what happens is Congress, Republicans and Democrats, pass the Detainee Treatment Act. And that's not only a serious kick in the teeth to our clients, that demonstrates the utter inability of our Congress to really deal with this current situation or willingness to deal with it. And what that act does is three things. One is it says the courts can't hear these cases anymore. The courts have no right to even consider why people are detained. Then it says evidence from torture can be used to keep people in prison. And the third thing it says is if anybody is tortured in Guantanamo, they cannot sue for torture. So recently what came up is one of our co-counsel brought a lawsuit. We brought one at the center, and another one of our co-counsel brought a lawsuit because people are being force-fed at Guantanamo. Huge, they're being strapped down. Huge tubes are being put into their noses. They're essentially being tortured through forced feeding. And what does the government come in and do? It says, well, we don't think this is torture. But in addition, even if it is, there's nothing you can do about it because our Congress has said you cannot do anything about torture. So we're facing really not just an administration run amok, but in many ways a Congress that has been really a stepping stone or a step stool, unfortunately, for that administration. The second issue, of course, we've been dealing with is this issue of torture. And here's where I've actually been the most disheartened. I mean, it's clear to all of us that this administration authorized torture. There's memos out there. There's the John Yoo stuff. There's that whole set of materials. And in the last few months, I've been doing a fair amount of speaking around the country at college campuses. And what I can't get over, really, is the way in which torture has really seeped into the fabric of this society. So that students come up to me all the time, and they say, well, they always ask, the first question is, what about the ticking time bomb? Then another one goes up to me and says, I sort of agree with what Alan Dershowitz is saying. You shouldn't torture people unless you have a judicial warrant to torture people. But this is, you know, it's funny, and I want to laugh, and I want to wring the student's neck. But what's going on out here is you have an administration that says it, you have a Congress in its law that's authorizing it, and then, as I'm going to get to, you have a court that is beginning itself to say you may be able to torture in the interest of national security. So we're reaching a point in this country when the public discourse is really adopting as part of it that we may be able to torture people in the interest of preventing terrorism or national security. And that brings me to the case we just lost, this case called Mahar Arar. Mahar Arar, I'm sure you all know, is the Canadian citizen. There's a couple of recent Bob Herbert columns about him. He was the guy who was rendered, sent to Syria for an extraordinary rendition for purposes of being tortured. We just lost the case right over the water here in the Eastern District of Brooklyn before a judge named Judge Traeger. Judge Traeger was a former U.S. attorney, lo and behold, the head of the Brooklyn Law School, which makes it hard for me to believe he wrote the opinion that he did. But if you have any doubts about what direction this country is going, you have to read that opinion. He dismisses the case. He has to accept that Arar is sent to Syria for torture, and he accepts that. He says, even assuming Arar is sent for torture, I'm dismissing this case because national security doesn't allow me to hear this case, because when you get into this case, it may affect our relations with Canada, a bunch of other BS in the case. But that's not the worst part of it. The worst part are two pages of the opinion where he goes on and he speculates about whether the Constitution of the United States bans torture. And what he says is, yes, in a criminal case, you can't torture somebody. You're not supposed to. It's illegal. And if there's any evidence from torture, you can't use that in a criminal case. But then he goes on, and it's not even necessary for the opinion. He goes on to say, well, it might be different in a case in which you're trying to prevent terrorism, that the Constitution may not prohibit torture if the purpose of the torture is for the purpose of preventing terrorism. Now, this is a federal judge sitting in the Eastern District of Brooklyn saying that it may be that as a constitutional matter that one can use torture. So we're sitting here now in a country where we have an administration that, as we all know, has completely undermined any kind of controls, any kind of checks and balances, any kind of constitutional framework. We're sitting here with a Congress that, from the McCain Amendment to the Detainee Treatment Act I talked about, to what they're doing with national security, spying right now, has completely gone along and been, as I said, a step stool, really, for this administration. And now we're seeing courts do essentially the same thing. I want to give one story and then end, but one story. We had a panel the other day that was incredibly moving to me. It was a panel that went, it was called From 1973 to 2006, From New Orleans to Abu Ghraib, Torture. And it was three Black Panthers who'd been tortured in 1973 in New Orleans. And they told the stories of their torture, terribly brutal torture. And then some of our attorneys had been to Guantanamo and worked with our clients there, told the stories of torture in Guantanamo. And when I started thinking about it, I started thinking, what is really going on here? What is this government doing with torture, both here and abroad, and why? And yes, some people say, well, you know, it's a ticking time bomb, you have to get the information. Other people say it's vengeance. But when, you know, the Black Panthers were there with me, I began to think about how when I was a child, what the role of lynching was. Of course, the role of lynching, there are many roles that it may have had, but one of them was clearly to terrorize the Black community, to make it so that a Black man, a Black woman, a Black child could not walk down the street and hold their head up. So it was an instrument of terror. And when people ask me, Michael, why at Guantanamo are they torturing people if it's not getting them the information they need? Why are they doing it? I would say it's the same reason they were doing it to the Black Panthers in 73, the same reason they still do it to people in the United States today, and the same reason they're doing it for people at Guantanamo. It's really to terrorize the community, in this case Guantanamo, to terrorize the Muslim community in particular, to say to them, you oppose the United States, you have your dignity, and we will take you to Guantanamo, and we will torture you. The last initiative which I'll mention, which I'm sure most of you have heard about, is the Center's book, Articles of Impeachment Against George W. Bush. And, you know, at first, when people, this did not originate, I have to say, the Center can't take that much credit for this. Some people came to the Center and they say, we want to write a book about impeachment. And we took our lawyers together, and in 2 or 3 weeks, we put this together. And what is remarkable to me, I'm, you know, skeptical about this kind of stuff, because obviously on some level here I am saying, forget about this Congress, and yet you got to get Congress to go ahead and impeach him. But I'm not looking at it that way. I'm looking at it as a way of saying, here I'm fighting a battle about Guantanamo, and what they're doing is then they have Bagram rising up over here. So I'm saying you have to put all of this together and look at this administration, whether it's the issues I care about, or that I, all of whom I care about, but that I work on the most, or whether it's Katrina or the war in Iraq, and you have to say this is a criminal administration, and you have to get rid of it. That's just the beginning. It's not the end, but it's certainly a first step. And what's remarkable is the program we did with Harper's was on C-SPAN. And the number of calls all over the country, literally hundreds of people all over the country who say, yes, go for it, we want to do this. And the polls reflect that. The polls reflect that something like 50% of the people in this country now think that if George Bush, which is like a joke saying the if he lied about the war in Iraq, he ought to be impeached. Or if he warrantlessly wiretapped people, he ought to be impeached. So while in my life as a human rights lawyer, I have never seen a situation so openly and notoriously of a government taking power to torture, detain, imprison, and spy on people in my life, I've also think we're coming to a point where there's enough opposition in this country and enough fight back where we can actually get somewhere. Thank you.
Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, speaking at the 2006 Left Forum. Thanks to Law and Disorder for that tape. You can hear their wonderful radio show and podcast at lawanddisorder.org. And you can download this and previous versions of our show, Unwelcome Guests, at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. And thanks to Skidmark for the patriotic music.